terrible too short.
Well, thanks for the warm welcome, and it's lovely to be here in Cork. I've just been here once before, and that was years and years ago, so it was really nice arriving here today at around 6 o'clock and kind of stroll around. And, I think I'll just get on with reading some poems. I'm going to read maybe for 25, 30 minutes, but if you've had enough after 15 or 20, you know you can give me the signal and stop. Okay, so the first poem I'm going to read is what I call my lucky poem, or, well, it's one of those poems that you write and you kind of think, oh, you know, you feel good about it. And it has been quite lucky for me, this poem. And even though, well, it's a bit of a strange poem, but I'll let you hear it and you can decide yourself if it deserves to be called a lucky poem or not. So it's called A Poem That Thinks It Has Joined a Circus. A handkerchief is not an emotional hold all. A cup of tea does not eradicate all the smothering sensations. A hands-on approach is not the same as a hand on the shoulder, willing a chin to lift and an upper lip to stiffen. A forehead resting on fingers does not imply that the grains of sand in an hourglass have filtered through. A set of eyes staring into space is not an indictment that the sun came crashing down in the middle of the night. A sigh that causes trembling and wobbly knees should be henceforth and without warning trapped in a bell jar and retrained to come out tinkling ivories with every gasp. A poem trying to turn a sad feeling on its head does not constitute a real poem. It is a tam-tam poem, dancing on a pinhead and walking a tightrope with arms spread tightly by his side. So, the second poem, well, can you hear me okay?
Oh yeah.
So, when I come back to Ireland, I always enjoy a quick look at the Lake Show to see what's happening in the country. It's kind of like a barometer of things in Ireland. And on one particular occasion, they happened to be talking about angels. And so I wrote a poem about the different things that were talked about regarding angels. And it's called A Lady in the Bath with Angels. Ever since that lady on the Late Late Show said that an angel makes itself known through the appearance of a white feather, every which way I turn, I'm seeing white feathers. A present, a tiny one, is sitting on my words jotting down notebook. I have up to 10 others in various hideaways about the house. The lady said that her first angel appeared to her while she was in the bath. They weren't tiny nor floaty, but 6 feet tall, hunky and blonde. She said that people don't want to hear about angels being so big, and that we've got to shed preconceived notions about angels. The interviewer said that people nowadays would fear seeing white feathers about the place and think only of bird flu and how risky it is to sit around lakes and swarm watch. The lady thinks that angels won't come unless we ask them to. She says they will do anything for us, but we have to summon them. She says, we each have an angel and that they want to save us and the world, but they stay quiet until we believe in them. I want to believe in angels, but gathering white feathers is a possessive act. I'd like to let them go. But meanwhile, how do I learn to mouth something significant to an angel? And as an anecdote to that poem, last week I was in Dublin for a few days, and walking down a common street, I actually did see a lady in an 80s power suit trying to pick up a white feather from the ground. Okay. So, the next poem is a Ralph poem. And it has quite a strange connection because it's got a Lily the Pink in it. I don't know if you've ever heard of that song, Lily the Pink.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of from the 80s, isn't it? And I only know like one line of the Lily the Pink song, you know, and the fact that it rhymes with drink, drink, drink type of thing. So it must have made some kind of a subconscious impact because it's ended up in this poem, and a love poem, no less. So, this poem is called Sing Me, a type of Lily the Pink song. And it goes a little wild, I think, with sounds and stuff, more so than sense. Ring out the liquor from the backs of my knees. Hoist the flag from the tresses of my hair. Sink a ship from the blueprint of my mind. Deliver a blow from the thud of my bottom on the eve of the leftovers. Set a match to the hope falling in dollars like sap from the lap in my heart. Rescue me an old-fashioned tune. Roll me over, not in clover, but in the fluffiness snipped and snapped by the way it flies. Handle me in new age syndrome to send me singing into all ages. Sing me a sort of Lily the Pink song to tickle my fancy down through all my days. Leave on to me, leave on to mine, the very best smoothie kiss on the cherry lips of my most recent inner self. So, the next poem I'm going to read is connected with some childhood memories of Sunday and the rituals of a Sunday. And it's a little like the weather we've been having now, those kind of 70s summery Sundays of sun and HD ice cream. So it's called Sunday with Ritual. My father's call for spare silver for the priest's money box is a Sunday ritual. So too is the rag my mother uses to polish shoes that she later positions in front of the fireplace. My father's hair refuses to stay up at the sides. It is flattened in place by a smear of Brill Cream to give it the Brill Cream bounce promised earlier on the Saturday night TV ad. My mother's perfume exudes the chant, tell them I'm a lady. She flicks her wrists, snaps shut her purse, now bursting with rosary beads on top of loose change. Her high heels click differently in preparation for walking up the aisle to receive the body of Christ. Afterwards, there will be wafers of Neapolitan HB ice cream. My mother will read out her horoscopes to let herself in on what is happening and to both warn us of and delight us in what may lie ahead. So, I'm going to read a poem that I've never read aloud before. It's just a very short poem. And it's about a poem about seeing the light and how sometimes it's not exactly what we after when we do see the light. It's called The Sun Splits. The Sun Splits. I am crossing the road when the sun splits. All its rays and yellowness come whirling down like a circus act. The acrobatics of me sidestepping the sun crashing causes a horror of orange squash. I am all fingers and thumbs and long lost halos, a complete mangle of brightness, while the sun's skinny legged parts are hula hooping on 20,000 streets. I lie trampled on the pavement, a complete invasion of light is knocking the stuffing out of me. Seeing the light is never all it is cracked up to be. Okay, and the next poem was written after reading about the shoe-throwing incident in Iraq. I don't know about, if you remember, when the Iraqi journalist threw the shoe at ex-President Bush. So I wrote it from that incident, and then it grew into other foot-themed things. So it's called Feet and Mud and Shoes. A mountain emerging from a molehill is the stuff of love on a bender. People who look the gift horse in the mud need a long stretch of the imagination to outwit the lady who is trying to have everything. I keep the eggnog for after. The fruitcake is in a tin box, unsealed and waiting a sharp tongue. I think of shoes and tyranny and the Melvin Marcus, and how her shoes tumbled out of a wardrobe as she was skirting the issue. A shoe obsession is a woman thing, or so they say. Top models with spindly legs on platform shoes are prepared to fall on catwalks. It is a case of putting one foot forward and stepping 2 feet backwards from the moving crowds. When rage reaches the inner quarters, a mind is willing to go bare. Put one foot firmly in one's mud, why not? There are too many people pussyfooting under the table with shoes on. One could rid oneself of shoes, look a tyrant in the eye, aim high. If he dodges, well and good. The tyrant can dodge all he likes. Isn't that the essence of being a tyrant? He dodges until all the good folk in the land give one, two, or three psychics of bravery. And stand barefoot in public and watch their shoes soar to a hair's breadth of a tyrant's head. The tyrant does one wrong. There is no salt of the earth in his standing upright behind a pedestal and ducking like some quack without a modicum of sense. In bad times, one goes barefoot. My mother and father went barefoot all of their school lives. Except in winter, they sometimes had a pair of too tight boots. They carried a piece of turf in the school fireplace. The soles of their feet hardened, and to this day, their small ritual is to steep their feet in a dish of water and await the softening. The water cools too quickly in winter, no sooner in than out again. She carries the dish. His toes poke upwards. We have no idea what people mean when they give up their shoes, or why some people end up with no shoes to start with. The next poem, it's a relationship poem again. Well, it's got like dragons, knives, bourbon, and eventually a type of settling down to lunch. It's called Cosmic Noise. Cosmic Noise. You say I wave my arms about too much, as if to slay a baby dragon that has only come to lay its head wherever it can find some baby dragon loves. I say talking 19 to the dozen is simple cosmic noise, a belly rumble amongst the stars, nothing to turn one's head. You take the slices of bacon from me. You say I dice too much, holding the knife over the sink as if the knife might turn on me of its own accord. I take the last date from the sticky packaging and begin to swallow the stone and throw away the date. You pull the stone from me and rescue the date. It will not simply be bacon and eggs today. It will be bacon, a la other things, all mixed to perfection, the parsley afloat, adding a pinch of je ne sais quoi to everything. I have come through the swinging door 3 times, leaving it to swing in my aftermath, like a saloon door in a western after the bourbon is drunk and the wagon out of sight. I settle to enjoy lunch. You settle to enjoy lunch. 2 people, their bearings found and settling.
Okay.
let's see. I have some variety here, so I'm wondering. Yeah, I'll read you a poem about my dogs. It's called, Mostly My Dogs Excel the Gods. Well, I don't think it's too stuffy, really. No, I don't think so. But. So, mostly my dogs excel the gods. My dogs like to chorus, one soprano to the other alto. A stake in the heart is a be-all and end-all. Disarming comes into it. So too do toes crush when the signal seems approaching as if elastic. My dogs want to be subtle, the underbelly touch, the earlobe and the inner sanctum, the palm with food on top, the finger taking encrusted sleepers from the eyes. My dogs do not buy time. A rollover makes time seem gelatine, the wag of tail not unexpected. My dogs are a twosome, one pink to the other's perk. A heart tablet in a blob of patty is a fitting nightcap. I speed it through the outer fence. I watch them lick their chops, a sort of Excelsior Dale. Mostly, my dogs sell the gods. On my knees, I reach out. There is a pivotal moment. I take it, the long, the short, the wonder, echoing. And, well, I'm going to risk it and read this poem here, which, well, anyway. Where I live, we have lots of hairpin bends and blind corners, you know. So when I first learned to drive there, I had to lie to my parents and say the roads were perfectly straight and there were no such things as blind corners. But it's just totally all blind corners. So, on one particular corner, there's always a rooster hanging out in it. I've been living in the Canaries for 14 years. I've been driving for 10. And practically every day, there is some sort of rooster on this really dodgy corner. So, this poem is about this rooster and what goes through my mind as I see him there, you know? And a few other things also. It is called Rooster on a Dangerous Bend, or There is No Satisfaction in Losing One's Hat. So it's a little long as well, so bear with me. Rooster on a Dangerous Bend. Why is there always a rooster on the sidelines of the dangerous bend I drive round each day? This rooster always looks restless. He glares into passing cars. He does not appear to pick nor dab the ground like one would expect a rooster to do. I stare him out of it. Luckily, the bend is open. In my head, I shoo him away from danger. I appeal to an oncoming driver with my eyes. Take it easy, there is a rooster there. Says my eye-only appeal. Is this rooster trying to undo or relive the eternal question of why the chicken crossed the road? Yeah. Is it really the little things that trip us up? Why do I flinch when the moon appears hypothetical? I do not want to appear miscellaneous, nor run short of a rabbit, nor, for that matter, a hat. My husband lost his hat. Not in the sense of losing his rag, but in the sense of a flux without agitation, a something big annoyance, added to by the fact that in the lost property office, they are lost unto themselves and do not answer the phone. It is not as if we are going to ask, what is the Spanish for glass monkeys? At least my husband is visible to passing nights in the, to passing ships in the night, the rooster too, I imagine. 10 years later, how can it be the same rooster? All bolstered up and defying a ramming car. Do these roosters have a replacement pack? One steps out, the other steps in. The eternal dance of Lanigan's ball and the welcome on the mat, even if Irish eyes stop smiling. And what of the rooster that crows 3 times? Is it proof of treachery? Is it some sort of tale in my own small world? Or is it simply me bursting out of shape while a rooster slaps itself against my car? I am caught red-handed, sugar sugar crackling on the car radio. I think about how a spare tire can drive one to an early grave, while this rooster in its comfiness is spannering my works, is cheered as innocence like little slices of purgatory. This poem is another childhood poem. This time it's related to the whole thing of being good. A hard concept to pin down. And it's called, Please Be Us Good Till I Come Back. Being good meant enjoying an egg cupful of milk with a spoonful of sugar. Our tiny index fingers and thumbs held the makeshift champagne glass the way we saw the Queen on TV do, even when the cat in the nursery rhyme was within his rights to look at her. Being good meant sitting together on a settled bed, plump legs dangling, as we tried to make shadow puppets on the wall. Sometimes the light failed us. Other times it was the awkward entwining of fingers only ever used to holding and not unlacing. Being good meant doing what our granny said, even if she said, stop playing at horses and riders, one of you will fall over and then where will we be? Being good meant not shoving, nor thumping, nor sticking tongues out, nor making faces at each other. Ugly faces that we could be left with, if God chose to breathe time in that instant. Being good also meant no lunging, nor bows and arrows. It meant watching round at the giants and secretly wishing to be a giant, with little human slaves that could be found behind the salt cellar on the kitchen table. Being good meant letting our granny watch the news and see around six. This is when we find ourselves outside, swinging from tree branches, pretending to be horses and cowboys and Indians all at once, remaking arrows and holding chickens to ransom, as our granny sat glued to the news of the latest killing across the border. For being good didn't enter into things. Where being good was just for kids whose mammy was out in the field, saving crops and helping little cows get born. I'll read two more, is that okay?
Sure.
I'm kind of losing track of time and poems here, so. Yeah, this one is this poem is called Signs, and it's about signs, different types of signs, and the various descriptions of signs. Okay. Signs. Some signs are on a par with other signs, all are written into the guttural. A sign along the side of the road, with a bad bend in the middle, says, slow, wake on here. A test tube of his blood shaken by the nurse who still asks after his neighbor's daughter, who nearly married her son, is a sign that blood can be too thick or too thin, and that he can feel too shivery or too sweaty, accordingly. If your mother says the signs are on you, then you know that there is a mishap between you. She is saying to your face what she normally keeps wrapped up in a handkerchief at the back of a drawer with mothballs around it. It is a bad sign if there is not any sign of him either coming or going, and you know there is no man or no dog to see about. It is a sign that something is up if you hear your own footsteps stop and you believe you're either a missing person or an enigma. A scientist exploring the will to live is a sign of the times that are in it. The low-angled winter sunshine coming in through the bedroom window shows up the seven different chemical reactions that your brain is undergoing during a lie-in. Four help with the thinking process, and the other three are making you add things up, with your childlike voice saying, look, 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 no hands. A sign stuck in snow and erringly pointing upwards makes you realize that you haven't turned your head for the last 50 miles and your heart is no longer content. So yeah, I'll read one more. Is that okay? Yeah. So the next one, yeah, it's related to cooking. Well, cooking triggered it off, but it's doing something else. This is sort of a lost one as well. Husband loves cooking. Well, he's Spanish and he really loves cooking, which is great for me. I get off the hook. And so this poem was inspired when I saw him chopping leeks. Chops a lot of leeks. And it's called Sometimes When You Are Bent Over Chopping Leeks. Sometimes when you are bent over chopping leeks, they see you on a red carpet, a fresh rose between the teeth. You airbrush your lucky stripes, thank your lucky stars. I hold your hand. We are practically icons of blondness. My Versace guy is slashed to the waist. We are so high, so as not to be able to walk straight. It is too soon to say if a promise might be dropped. For now, we are in ceremonial alignment, unmatchable, and sweeping the world. Okay, thank you very much.